Valentine's Day, Chris.
Sing around.
I
look
the part.
And what, today's Oregon's birthday also?
It certainly is. 148.
Wow. Two more years to the...
4 years to the sesquicentennial or whatever you call that.
Sesquicentennial. So we have two public hearings today, one on Senate Bill 39, which is the voluntary compliance abusive tax shelter legislation that Senator Monroe's been heading up a work group on. And then we're going to just look at 211 again and kind of go through our options. So if we want to make some amendments, we'll have those ready to go and just schedule for a work session the next time we hear the bill. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 39. Chris, you want to? This is the first time we've had the public hearing, so you want to talk to us about the bill, and then I'll hand it over to Senator Monroe.
Okay, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 39, as introduced, directs the Department of Revenue to establish and promote a voluntary compliance initiative for taxpayers who utilize listed transactions to underreport personal income or corporate income or excise taxes. It establishes reporting and registration requirements and enhanced penalties for people who use certain transactions or who serve as material advisors for certain transactions to underpay tax liability. It extends the period for which notice of deficiency may be issued in cases in which returns reflect use of certain transactions to underpay tax liability. It also directs the Department of Revenue to establish a general tax amnesty program of limited duration, waives penalties for personal income taxpayers who pay outstanding taxes, increases penalties on taxpayers who fail to fully participate. The Sunset Amnesty Program sunsets on January 2, 2012. It requires mandatory withholding of income tax from distributions from employer-sponsored retirement plans. And finally, the bill allows the Department of Revenue to disclose certain income tax return information to local governments. And one note on that last part, that was essentially what has been passed out of committee in Senate Bill 173.
Yes, and so we worked on it in the interim, and Senator Monroe, you've been working on an amendment to the bill, and a group of folks, so the next hearing we'll have will probably be on what you come up with.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. We've had two work group meetings, the work group consisting of myself, Representative Butler, Representative McPherson. Representative McPherson was there for a short time at our first of those two meetings. Jody, who's in the back here, and of course Chris has helped us, Deborah, and Elizabeth was at our last meeting as well from the department. Kind of the first tentative decision that we made was to probably not go for a full-blown tax amnesty program, but rather look at increasing the activities of the department, some of the tools that the department needs. They've actually had a significant increase in enforcement activities on their own, and they simply need additional resources to continue that effort. So kind of the direction we're going would be to amend the bill so that the department can go back perhaps as much as 8 or 10 years. Currently there's a limit of 3 years that they can go back. So this would allow them to get back into the late 90s, where there seems to have been a lot of folks that didn't pay their taxes that we need to go after. Perhaps also then have a significant increase, as recommended by the department, in some of the penalties, and set a time certain when those new penalties would kick in so that the department could notify delinquent taxpayers that you can come forward now and you'll pay only the current level of fines, or they can even waive some of those. They can't waive the interest. I think they can waive the penalties. But that if they don't come forward, that as of whatever that 90-day or 120-day period, then the new penalties kick in and it'll be much more severe. That's kind of the direction I think we're going. I asked at our last meeting, asked Chris to work with the department to ask them and codify what tools they feel they need to do their job better, to be more effective in their collections efforts. And they've had some meetings, but they are not yet ready to report on that to me. When they tell me they're ready, we'll reconvene the subcommittee, put things together, and then have something to present to this committee in the form of amendments to Senate Bill 39.
Questions for Senator Monroe? So just a timetable. I guess you're waiting to hear back from the Department of Revenue in terms of the question of what tools do you need.
I hope I'll have that information within a week. So I would say if you scheduled us in 2 weeks, maybe, that might be appropriate.
So you're going to call that group back together one more time after you get that information?
I get the information from Chris that and from that work group with the department, Elizabeth primarily, and Deborah working with Chris. Then we'll schedule our subcommittee, and that usually takes about a week to get everybody together. So we're probably talking 2 weeks till that subcommittee can meet. So it might be as much as 3 weeks before we're back here.
As soon as possible.
I know.
other questions for Senator Monroe heading up this subcommittee or work group? So, Dave, can you talk to us briefly about the amnesty? And I had talked to you about the Indiana program, and I think you'd met briefly with, but I think that'd be interesting for the committee to hear, just since we're at a somewhat of a decision point in that subcommittee of whether to include anything or just let that one be removed.
Yes, and the Indiana program, and you'll hear that. Of course, they're a sales tax state, and most of the states that have done tax amnesty, it's sales tax based. So we're in a little different situation. Mr. Fiskum and his associates have been in discussions with me about this whole plan. In fact, Mr. Conkling attended our last work meeting and spoke to the group for a time.
He did.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Dave Fiskum here this morning representing Sallie Mae. And as you know, Mr. Chair, Sallie Mae has had some experience. In fact, a couple of its subsidiaries are major debt collection enterprises in this country and collect past due debts. In fact, for state of Oregon agencies as well as the IRS. And so people think sometimes that Sallie Mae is a student loan organization, which in fact today it still is, and that's its main line of business for which it's known. But it also has substantial debt collection capability, and in fact ran for the state of Indiana of a major general tax amnesty program for Governor Daniels in that state. Our interest in this legislative session, stemming from our involvement, Mr. Chair, with you and other members of the previous revenue committees, was in kind of two areas. And one is we wanted to be a resource to you for purposes of general tax amnesty issues, as close as this legislature came in 2005 to passing a bill, then Senate Bill 480. We wanted to be involved as a resource. And in fact, pre-session of Sallie Mae individuals came out a couple times and were appreciated the chance to meet with the Department of Revenue, Ms. Archenko and her staff, and we had good discussions, again, in terms of a resource of the experience we had in Indiana. The second role we have, and we've been very careful to emphasize this, is if this state decides, the policymakers in this state decide to enter into a tax amnesty program, and secondly, if there was an interest in contracting with a private company, private vendor, to run such a program under an official contract with the state of Oregon, our interest is in competing for that business, and we would fully intend to compete for it as opposed to be handed it. That's very important for me to emphasize that, because we're not trying to drive on the Sallie Mae is not trying to drive on the public policy of doing an amnesty unless you and your colleagues, Mr. Chair, and the House and the agency is interested in heading in that direction. That said, what I'm not prepared to do today, but would be happy to provide you information that I don't have with me today on our experience in Indiana, information that we provided to the Department of Revenue, and it's interesting background. You're very right to characterize the two states as very different in terms of their tax structure and tax policy, and so what happened in Indiana for the good of Indiana wouldn't necessarily happen in the same way exactly in Oregon. We recognize that. Our information is available to you as a resource. I'd be pleased to provide that. And we have a folder or a pamphlet or a two-page handout that we gave, in fact, to the work group the other day. But if in your wisdom, general tax amnesty is not your direction, we'll settle for that. We'll monitor this issue as you go forward in 2 or 3 weeks. And if there's a role for us to play in providing information, we're pleased to do that. And eventually, if there's a role to compete for the state's business under contract in the debt collection tax and pass through tax collection arena, we'd be pleased to compete. That's probably it for now. I'd be pleased to try to answer questions, and I'm sorry I don't have my tax amnesty folder with me today to provide you, but be pleased to do that at your discretion, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions for Mr. Fiscom? So I think it would be helpful, and maybe Gary Conkling did this with the work group, but give it your best, whatever the best. I was fairly impressed in the interim with the information, and I understand Indiana, a different state than Oregon, and perhaps that's the disqualifier there, but I was fairly impressed with the information that was presented. And so at whatever time, and if Gary's done this, then it's done. But get to that work group with the best possible case scenario or the best case for an amnesty. And
sure. I should add, Mr. Chair, for the record, we've appreciated the access we've had to the Department of Revenue over the months, as well as to you and members of the previous revenue committees, as well as Senator Monroe's willingness to allow us to participate in his work group. So we feel like we've had a chance, and we'll take further chances to make our perspectives known. But again, I think it's the policy issue is one you face, and if we can help decide that, we're pleased to do so. But it's in the spirit of my comments that I want to just express Sally Mays' appreciation for the record.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you,
Dave. Deborah Buchanan, Eric Smith, and then Ms. Spencer will have you up afterwards.
Good
Happy
morning,
Valentine's
Mr. Chairman.
Day.
Thank you, sir.
You bet.
That may be the only acknowledgement. We're not big at that at home, but that's just great.
Well, tell us more about that.
No, I think I've said enough already. I'm sorry. Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. And Senator Monroe has described the activities of the work group very well and what our charge is. So I think what we wanted to do was just talk about perhaps some of the options that we have considered in the work group, have discussed, and what we're talking about at the department now in trying to develop options for you to consider. And one of those is just building on yesterday's presentation that Elizabeth Parshenko gave to the committee about the Multi-State Tax Commission, its activities, what it does on behalf of the various states. And with me I have Eric Smith, who's the Corporate Tax Program Manager. He's been really the point person for the department in working with a subcommittee of the MTC developing almost an administrative voluntary compliance initiative, if you will, that various states are participating in. So I asked him to come over and just talk with you for a few minutes about what that group has done and the status of their efforts, so that in looking at Senate Bill 39, you might weigh that as an option versus a standalone VCM. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Deckert, Senator Monroe. My name is Eric Smith, and I am the Corporate Tax Program Manager for the Department of Revenue. And as Deborah said, the Multi-State Tax Commission has offered to facilitate a voluntary compliance initiative and be a single point of contact nationally. And 31 states in the country have said they would be interested in participating in that. And so I've had the pleasure over the last several months of working with four other states in a subcommittee to design that voluntary compliance initiative. And we've received the benefit of the experience from the states of California, New York, and Illinois, who are part of our subcommittee, to help us design a compliance initiative that will hopefully be a little bit more streamlined because of the experience that they learned from the compliance initiatives that they had. Some of the benefits that we're hoping to gain from doing an initiative through the MTC is that with 31 states, that's a large body of tax jurisdictions that a taxpayer can come forward and amend to one entity, the MTC, one place instead of the different jurisdictions they're in if they're a multi-state corporation. Excuse me. So they have a single point of contact, and that we can be uniform in how we administer that. You don't have different states with different requirements. We have one process that they can all comply with. We're also providing incentives that are within our statutory authority as the different states are coming forward. That's the process that we're in right now. Different states, as we currently have authority to waive penalty for compliance purposes, we're all defining clearly what each state can present as an opportunity for taxpayers to receive in terms of an incentive if they come forward. And so there is going to be relief for taxpayers who come forward under this who otherwise might receive penalties if the activity that they are participating in is found out by the various states. The basis primarily for defining the activity, the tax abuse activity, is the listed transactions that the IRS has posted on their website. There are 30 listed transactions, and that's been the core foundation for most of the compliance initiatives across the country. So it's well-defined. It's out there. It's not something new. The time frame that we're looking at to launch this compliance initiative is later this spring and have it run through the summer, though it's not defined completely yet because we're still in our final stages of actually bringing the 31 states on board and dotting the I and crossing the T with our process, so that might slide a little bit. In Oregon, what we'll hope to do is when we launch this is we'll have a significant advertising campaign to let anyone know. In addition to sending letters to over 7,000 taxpayers that have come forward in other states and compliance initiatives and letting them know, we know you have amended in another state. Please come forward and amend in Oregon if you're a taxpayer in Oregon who should amend. In addition to those taxpayers, we're going to make it clear that it's an opportunity for people to come forward and participate in this compliance initiative and receive the same relief and penalties that they might otherwise face. So that, in a nutshell, is the compliance initiative the MTC is putting together.
And so you're prepared to go with that later this spring, the administrative compliance initiative. What was my question? How do you advertise to let folks know? I mean, many of these cases, I think, are folks that live or they're incorporated outside of Oregon. So how do you let folks know, how do you advertise to them that there's going to be an administrative compliance initiative starting in April, May?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the Multistate Tax Commission has a lot of contacts with different tax publications or industry has their own groups that focus on tax issues, and we're well connected, and we have many avenues to get the word out.
Question, do you have any questions?
Well, I just wondered how the legislation that we're working on would dovetail with what you're planning.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Monroe, that's exactly what we're working on in the work group right now, is trying to figure that out, because the legislation that you have now is very similar to model regulations or legislation that the MTC also has adopted for other states to consider with regard to reportable transactions and a compliance initiative. And what we're looking at particularly are the reportable transactions portions of Senate Bill 39, mm-hmm. the increased penalties, maybe the statute of limitation, the requirements to report the types of activities that may be abusive. And so those are the things we're looking at right now in the work group to try and see are there some benefits to having that. And then there's a timing issue of when those would actually become law and when this compliance initiative might take place. But
yeah, that concerned me. You talked about this later this spring, and you know, which maybe puts a little rush on our work here. And you know, if you need additional tools, we'd like to be able to give them to you in time for what you plan. So,
thank you.
Is staffing an issue we've heard, at least in other venues, that having agents available to go out and do the work is one of the helpful points that Senator Monroe brought up. Is that correct?
Chair Deckert, staffing has been a challenge in some of the other states that have had large compliance initiatives, and they staffed up for that. One of the things that we're trying to do, because we are like many other moderate to small-sized states that don't have near the resource of a California and New York, is to try and gain from the activity and the experiences they've had and the information they've had. The information that they have is what is so valuable, and try and use the resource we have to maximize our compliance effort. I think you could probably ask any tax compliance manager if they would like more staff, and they'd probably grin. But I think in terms of identifying specific staff that we would need for this project, that's not something that I'm ready to talk to at this moment. We're trying to do this project with the MTC within our current staff level and design it in a way that it's not going to bury us.
The federal government is engaged in what seems to be a pretty aggressive, if at least what I read and hear is correct, effort around this issue too, of folks that are not complying with the tax system and getting them back in compliance. How does that work with the state statute that Senator Monroe is working on?
Chair Decker, that works well. In fact, a lot of the activity that we've been doing, even within our own administrative authority over the last couple of years, has been using leads from the Internal Revenue Service to identify taxpayers in Oregon who have participated in abusive tax shelters. And so that's the IRS and their project is something that other states. California's success really was tied to launching their program at the same time that the IRS did. And we know that that's an integral partnership to our success. So looking to use IRS information is definitely a part of our compliance activity for ATAC.
Well, so the California experience speaks to having the years allowing that long time span, and maybe 8 to 10 years is not enough to ensure that you have plenty of years available to go back and ensure that. That was my understanding from California, is that they needed a good time frame to be able to go back and find folks that weren't complying. Is that correct?
Chair Decker, that is true. That was a part of their success, as they extended the period that they could go back. And they conducted their initiative almost 4 years ago. And so looking back at that time was back into the late 90s when our economy was really heated up.
Yeah. We had one teed up and ready to go, and that closed last time. I think this time will hopefully be different. Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Spencer. I won't say happy Valentine's Day. I'll just good morning.
Well, how about happy birthday to Oregon?
Oh, happy birthday to Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Senator Deckert, members of the committees, I appreciate this opportunity to speak to you today. I come as a representative of Service Employees International Union, Local 503. We represent the workers that work at the Department of Revenue, and we would like to be team players on this Senate bill and offer expertise if there's any need. I know that Deborah Buchanan and of course Ms. Harchenko and a lot of the folks that have testified or given you input certainly are quite learned on the issue, but we want to offer as private citizens if our members can come forward and be of any help.
Great. That's
okay.
Helpful.
Okay.
Senator Monroe.
Yeah, would you like to be included in the next meeting of our work group?
Mr. Chair, Senator Monroe, I would not offer myself. I think that we would want someone to be able to attend if possible.
Okay.
On their own time.
Let Chris know who you want to be notified,
okay.
And when we have another work group, we'll notify that person.
Thank you, sir. I'll take that back to the group.
And I always forget to get you to ID, so they gave me this card, like a soccer ref, for ID. You just have to identify yourself.
Oh, okay. Oh, I'm sorry. Leah Spencer?
With SEIU.
With SEIU, yeah.
Great. No, thank you. Other questions for Ms. Spencer? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee.
So that's all we have signed up for Senate Bill 39. We should, not to put pressure on, have this issue back in 10
ASAP.
Days.
We'll get it as quick as we can.
Trying to move issues along rapidly this session. So 10 days to 2 weeks. We'll put it back up for a public hearing and possible work session the next time Senate Bill 39 comes up on the docket. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 39. Thank you, Chris. And open a public hearing on Senate Bill 211. Great. So, but perhaps if we could have, if the department just come up, what I wanted to do with this hearing is just one thing, and that is use this to draft an amendment to the bill that we've already heard. Eric Richards from the department and Brian Reeder, we all know Brian. So my hope would be, we've heard this bill, it deals with high-cost disability, is to just have us draft whatever, work on whatever amendment we're going to work on. And Steve, you were going to talk about the three issues that seem to be on the table.
Mr. Chair, Committee, Senate Bill 211, as you recall, deals with two components of the school equalization formula. One was the 11% cap on the number of students that a district can claim for an extra IEP weight in the formula, and that gets increased to 12.5% in the bill. The other item was to increase the amount of dollars that would go into the high-cost disability grant. That's to fund costs above $30,000 for those students with high-cost disabilities. Those were the two components of the bill. Where the discussion kind of centered last time was to not change the 11%, and the amendment request at that time was to delete that language and to keep the $18 million increase for the high-cost disability. Now that has not been drafted, but that's was the center of the discussion at that time.
Okay, so let's, and do folks need a, does everyone remember the bill and the issue?
I do, Mr. Chair. If I could, ask what I should have asked this at the original hearing, but what's the rationale for the $30,000 cutoff for being able to tap into the fund?
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Eric Richards. I'm with the Oregon Department of Education's Office of Student Learning and Partnership. When the legislation was enacted back in 2003, the figure was $25,000. And in the last session, it was increased to $30,000. We did a survey of nine states in the region and found that that figure was the bar was lower at $30,000 than in those other nine that we surveyed. But all the parties that were involved in arriving at what they thought would be a fair figure in Oregon concluded that $30,000 would probably be a good place to set that bar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, so on this first issue of 11, I thought it was the committee was, if not near consensus, at consensus, that keep it at 11%, not go to the 13%. And then the other issue was to keep the $18 million, but then in talking to Steve and remembering Kent Hutzikers, which I thought he was correct on this testimony, is that if you're at $18 million, you're fully reimbursing. And so there's no, I guess, that strive factor that Kent spoke to of, if you're at 90% or less than 100, then you're not, and I don't see him in the audience, but then you're not being fully reimbursed. So there's the incentive, I guess, is not 100%. So we could, I would certainly consider lowering, going under $18 million, so that you haven't fully 100% reimbursed every cost.
Mr. Chair, do we know for sure that $18 million would reimburse everything everywhere at $30,000? Do we have that data?
We do, Steve.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, the data that we have the last year was the $15.4 million, and I believe that was an 05-06 figure. And so you would have potential increases for a year or two above the $15.4 million. So whether it would get to 18 million by 0708. Maybe not.
I guess I'm to follow up, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm having trouble seeing the value of only a partial reimbursement because it comes from other students in the district. I mean, I don't see, to me, these are pretty much fixed costs, and I don't see what, if there were an incentive where they could somehow lower the cost for these students, that might be a factor, but it's my understanding, you know, from seeing a lot of these kids, that these are pretty much fixed costs. So I'm not troubled by
the 100%
reimbursement at all.
And I'm Steve, do you want to articulate? You're the person I talked to about, and I know you're not speaking for, but Kent Hunsinker, who is not here, you're the one that I talked to about the 90%, or do you want to articulate it better than I did of why you would not go right up to the 100% reimbursement?
Mr. Chair, no, I'm not a proponent of of any level, whatever you feel comfortable with, but that is just one consideration in coming up with what that total grant number should be.
So the answer is no, he does not want to. Well, whatever the will of the committee, I thought Kent made a decent point. I'm certainly happy with 100%. I do think there is a case to be made for allowing districts or providing that incentive not to, if they're fully reimbursed. I do think somehow that you lose a little bit of your incentive, similar to that whole transportation conversation. But
Mr. Chair, I will add though that the $18 million would eventually probably be exceeded. So it wouldn't be 100% for very long.
Very long, if we set it at $18 million.
If we can start there, to me the important thing is after the discussion of the committee, is to stay at 11%, so you don't have basic creep in terms of people having an incentive to use the money. But these are pretty extraordinary cases. These above 30,000 have.
Mm-hmm. Growing extraordinary. $18 million?
Yeah, I'm there. I concur. I was the one that asked for the amendment to be drafted to put the 12.5 back to 11, to keep it at 11. That way, districts have to justify any amount above that, and I think that's appropriate. We did have a lot of conversation about what that justification involves, and it doesn't involve very much. It's not onerous at all. Mm-hmm. So I don't think that's a problem. $18 million will soon be exceeded, I'm sure, as Steve said. So it's probably appropriate to set it at that level. I thought I heard a number that they thought this year it would be in the $17 million something. A couple of years ago it was $15.4 million, mm-hmm. Steve says. I thought we had the department say that they thought the expenses this year would be in somewhere in the $17 million range, and which means by next year it'll be over 18 probably. So let's just leave it at 18.
And I see nodding from Eric that it is in the $17 million range, we think, this year.
Chair Decker, committee members, in the process of the high-cost disability fund, I apologize, Eric Richards with the Oregon Department of Education. There are two estimates currently that are offered. The first one is in December, and then the districts have an opportunity to come back and amend their estimate for 06-07 in February. So that's still in process. So we couldn't give an exact figure, but that's, I believe, estimated at this point what it might come in around.
Great. Okay. Second issue was this whole waiver process. And to me, at least the discussion, and Senator George and I talked about it after, is how do you, to me, the way the department checks to see if, you know, if for the waiver, to me, doesn't seem adequate to just look at the numbers and measure the numbers up. And I guess the interest I would have is there a better way, a more conclusive way to go out and check rather than just looking at the books to ensure that the students truly are IEP and a better barometer than just looking at the books and seeing if they spent more than came in.
Chair Deckard, members of the committee, actually there is a process, and I probably didn't elaborate on this enough in the last hearing. The first thing we look at is, did they exceed the 11% cap, and did they spend more than they took in? Because if they took in more revenue than they expended, they're not eligible. So that's the first step. Then you get into the formula process, and that involves looking at each of the claims for another weight and what the type of disability is, the severity of it, and making decisions about how to best allocate that money. So every one of the kids who are given, or every claim does involve with certainty a child on an IEP. And usually the more severe the disability, the greater likelihood additional weight will be granted in that claim process. And Brian, did you have anything you might want to add?
For the record, Brian Reeder, Department of Education. Chair Deckard, I think you have a legitimate concern, and that is that are we paying for students who really are not special ed students? And, you know, given the rather extensive both federal and state requirements to develop an IEP and the rather lengthy process in doing that, I think what the department has concluded whenever it's looked into this is that we truly believe it's unlikely that students who don't belong on IEPs are actually being put on IEPs. For districts to initiate the IEP process simply to get additional money is, we're not finding really any evidence of that. I mean, it's an onerous process, and it's a process that involves the parents, involves the school district, and involves the student, and to go through that needlessly when the student truly doesn't qualify, we're just not finding evidence of that.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, and Monroe.
Yeah, my experience has been that 21 years as a public school teacher and 10 years on a school board. It's a very onerous procedure, often complicated, often confrontational, and it's not something school districts are going to go through needlessly.
So we are airtight on that question, and I certainly hear from Senator Monroe and from that we are solid in terms of if they are IEP designated, they are. Or we just have no information and no inkling that there is anything other than that standard. They're IEP, they are IEP, and nothing to really trigger curiosity there or concern.
Chair Deckard, I would say yes to that.
Great. Steve, were there other issues, or were those the...
Mr. Chair, that's all that I recall.
The waiver... And then, great. Other issues hopefully we would draft one amendment and then just reschedule the bill. Other issues that other folks remember? Thank you very much. Have a wonderful Valentine's Day, Oregon birthday. Okay, so we'll get that drafted, Steve, and then we'll reschedule when we have an amendment ready. Close public hearing on Senate Bill 39 and adjourn the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee till 8:45 tomorrow.